The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Well, we're delighted for the Culture Club tonight to have one of Ireland's most brilliant creative minds with us. A man who, as a playwright and a screenwriter, has worked with the likes of Cillian Murphy, David Bowie, Claire Keegan, many others, and who also has a new exhibit at the Galway Arts Festival. Well, it's an extension to an old exhibit that he's going to tell us about before we talk about his choices for the Culture Club. Enda Walsh, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, lovely to be here.
Tell us about Rooms, which is something that you've written and directed, an immersive theatre installation.
Yeah, it came about 11 years ago. We made the first room, which was a hotel sort of environment. So what it is from the outside, it looks like a big white box, a very, very large white box. And six audience are allowed inside it. And when they walk inside, they're in a real sort of environment, whatever it is. So we've done, first one was, yeah, this hotel. So it was a one-star hotel. So the audience sort of walk into this really super realistic sort of setting. And then this audio starts where I've written this audio for an actor, and it's like a monologue, I guess. And the audio starts, and it's, I guess, the person who passed through that room or is about to go to that room or has left that room or whatever has got some sort of association with that space. So after doing this one room 11 years ago, I said to Paul, oh my God, I should do a room every year until I die, because they're really quite extraordinary. So we've amounted to 11. And when we showed, I think it was sort of five of them together in the Barbican here in London, it's quite the experience for an audience. They last about sort of 15 minutes each one. So you go in, you experience this audio, this environment, the sort of ghosts of this person, and then you leave that, and then you go into another room, if you wish, and it's sort of like it's another like completely different sort of place, different voice. And yeah, they're really evocative. They go back to sort of how I remember when I started writing when I was 14, that notion of like, oh, writing is just about sort of meeting strangers. And it has this very... very sort of...
Explain that to me about meeting strangers.
Well, this was always my sort of sense of it as a kid. I thought, oh, I would like, you know, it was my... Literally, I started writing when I was 14, and I started writing people that weren't me. And I thought, oh, this is actually a way of me. I was a very sort of introverted little child, like as many writers were. And But I started sort of creating these characters that to me felt very, very real, very outside of myself. And it was just like sort of bumping into sort of these real life sort of, you know, 4D characters with histories and ambition and loves and hates and all of that.
So when you came to this idea of rooms, and how much fun is it then each year adding another room on?
I love it. Well, I said to Paul, I said, we should do it sort of like, we should do it this way. I should think about it for a week. You know, like I should write it in 5 days. We should record it in 2 days. We should mix it in 2 days. And during that time, the guys can sort of build the room. So they're very sort of like, they're wonderful to do, to sort of go back to. And like in my other work, it's a lot of storytelling is about structure and sort of rhythm and pace. These are really distilled sort of like simple pieces in many ways where you just meet a character. And you meet this sort of voice, whoever it is, and that to me, the relationship, I think, or the experience for the audience feels really, really confessional. What it feels like. You feel super, super close to, not to get all Catholic about it, but you feel super, super close to these people, and you're hearing things privately that they've never told to anyone. If that makes sense.
Okay, so how many rooms can people see at the Shed, Galway Harbour?
Well, I do one every year, but actually this year we're actually going to show two together. We're doing a changing room, which I did during the pandemic, which for obvious reasons, only like a couple of people were allowed in at a time. We still ran it. So it was really, really sweet. But we're going to do that again. And then we're doing the dining room, and which is a new piece that I wrote for Aaron Monaghan. So, yeah. I swear to God, I mean, if I'm remembered for anything, I probably won't be, but it will be these rooms. And if I manage to do one every year, I think they will amount. I keep on thinking of my sort of like when I was in Greendale School and our massive sort of gymnasium. And I was thinking, wow, the notion of walking to a gymnasium and seeing sort of 35 sort of big white boxes and each one of them sort of holding a person. is strong, I think.
We'll get back to your secondary school days at the end of the Culture Club because of the choice you've made there. But we always ask every guest to start with the first piece of music that they ever remember buying. And I see you've gone for, you're not the first person, Adam and the Ants and Stand and Deliver. Tell us about this.
Well, you know, I was thinking about, I could do the cool version and say it was Human League being boiled, but they came out about the sort of same time, I think. But I absolutely loved all the sort of theatre of it. I just thought it was ridiculous of all those back then, that new romantic thing. And I'm still a sort of big fan of electronica and electronic music. But that to me, I guess the early 80s, late 1970s, Gary Newman, all that sort of business. I love that. But yeah, the campness of, there's definitely a bit of pantomime inside me, although people wouldn't allow me near a pantomime for obvious reasons, but yeah, I love the campness and the pantomime of that.
Yeah, because only somebody, I can't remember, somebody recently was talking to us about Adam and the Ants in Culture Club and mentioned that originally Adam had been a punk, and I don't think you could really say Stand and Deliver was punk music. Maybe you could. Let's just have a reminder of it. Early 1980s music, and I've just been reminded it was very recently, it was Paul McLoone who was the one who actually picked out Stand and Deliver by Adam and the Ants as well. Your favourite album, Enda, is another one that comes up regularly, and this goes back to the 1960s, regarded by many people as one of the great classic pop albums, Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. Why have you chosen it?
I'm a huge Brian Wilson fan. I'm in my office now, and I've got two things on my wall. And one of them is a signed Pet Sounds tour sort of cover by Brian Wilson to me. He didn't know who I was, but someone was looking after him that time when he did that tour. And I think back then, certainly he was an absolute genius for melody and harmony. And the way that sort of album was put together, that sort of, you know, after and during sort of like a breakdown, I think he just went there. All my sort of like musical sort of heroes are people who've really, pushed the boat and, try to sort of develop new ways of recording and new sounds and all of that. And I mean, his melodies are beautiful, but they're so incredibly sort of intricate. And that album, Pet Sounds, is like, yeah, for many people is sort of groundbreaking. It's up there with sort of like, you know, Radiohead's OK Computer in terms of just it shifts everyone's sort of way of listening to music for a little bit, you know.
Let's hear from Pet Sounds, God Only Knows.
But long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me, so what good would living do me?
Oh, what a gorgeous song, God Only Knows, yeah, by the Beach Boys from Pet Sounds. Now, we asked you for a favourite band or artist. You gave us three excellent choices. Bjork, Kate Bush and Thom Yorke. Talk to me first about Bjork.
There's a wonderful thing. You can get it. I think it's there's a podcast of her explaining the each album. She talks about sort of like the recording of it and what she was trying to do. And anyone who's interested in Bjork or interested in music should listen to that podcast. They'll find it wherever they get their sort of podcast. But it's a really extraordinary thing. I mean, she just hears things completely different from a lot of people. And the ambition of things, I think she'll make an album and then she'll think about a new sound, a new way of sort of like listening to sort of and a new sort of structure for a pop track or a music track. And each album feels very, very different from the others. And they become more difficult, actually. And sort of for a lot of people, they become harder or sort of like more turgid or sort of, you know, and all of that. But I just find it just like fascinating that she's willing still just to, you know, just the risk of just trying to fail, you know, like risking failing and just going at it again and again and again. She's extraordinary.
You mentioned Radiohead earlier, but is Thom Yorke's individual work your preference, even against the brilliance of Radiohead?
I don't know. That's hard, actually. That's hard. But they feel like very sort of like different things. I love when Radiohead come together and hear them sort of collectively and the sound that they make. But I think I'm still trying to get my head around what this new sort of thing he's doing with Johnny Greenwood is, this Smile band. But I like his individual work he does himself. I love that. I think it was called Amina. I think it was out maybe about 6-7 years ago. And all the soundtrack work he does. I love his voice. I love his sort of like in the same way as sort of Damon Albarn has got, I think, amazing amounts of sort of melodies these people carry around in their heads. Thom Yorke has got that, but also he's got his voice is just so haunting at times, you know. It's really beautiful to me anyway.
And then Kate Bush.
Well, I think she's just the master. For me, I mean, I'm a huge sort of like, it's tricky, you know, it's impossible to sort of choose, of course, a best album or a best artist or whatever for someone who, like me, who listens to music all the time. But she's my go-to again and again, just where I'm feeling sort of a little bit. This sounds so pretentious, and I apologize to anyone out there. But, you know, there are a couple of people, like artists, that you just, when you're not feeling good about yourself or in terms of like the work is hard or you're not sort of like, you feel as if you're not accomplishing anything or whatever, I do go back and I listen to her music and what she's doing album to album. And then, you know, like I read about sort of Francis Bacon and Francis Bacon sort of interviews and stuff like that. And there are people, you know, there are artists in the past that have really, that you look to and help you sort of like, you know, get over and through the wall and sort of over that wall and into another place.
Let's hear a bit of Kate Bush, Cloud Busting. Cloud Busting from the Hounds of Love album by Kate Bush. I had expected you put David Bowie in there, the late David Bowie, given that you worked with him on his music Lazarus.
No, I mean, I do. I adore sort of like Bowie, but I don't know. I think those three people, particularly those two women, I must say, have had like a sort of a big influence on me. I mean, the last Bowie album I adored, and I play that sort of like fairly regularly, I suppose, probably twice a month. that is a beautiful, beautiful album for sure.
What's the best gig you've ever been at?
Huh. It's really hard. It's sort of like there's been many, and I think I sort of said that. I saw Beach House in Shepherd's Bush Empire. I think they were supporting another band, and I can't even remember who the other band was, but they were the support band, and they really sort of blew me away. I must say, I thought they were just extraordinary. Again, they're sort of like they're knocking out the albums. They're pretty sort of prolific, and that was extraordinary. But then I thought, oh God, no, sure. I saw Devo as well, and Devo were like an extraordinary band. When they came back, they played, not recently now, it must have been about 8 years ago when they sort of came back, and they played in London here, just a couple of gigs. And they were really, really extraordinary. Someone who Bowie actually sort of like adored and really, but yeah, they were hilarious. I don't know whether you remember back in the day in the sort of like mid-70s, whatever, they used to wear yellow jumpsuits. And now, of course, when I saw them, they were like middle-aged elderly men. And they came out and they said, you know, when we used to wear these, we were like, you know, cheeseburgers. Now we're like double cheeseburgers. And then and then they just launched into whatever they were playing. That was quite extraordinary.
Well, listen, let's hear a bit of Beach House. This is live from King's Theatre, different gigs than one you remember, but this is Space Song. Beach House and Space Song. We need to take a break. Ender Walsh is with us for the Culture Club, and we have lots of things to talk to him about in the second half of the Culture Club after this. Welcome back to the Culture Club. Ender Walsh is with us. You can see in Galway his new presentation, Rooms, as part of the Galway International Arts Festival. But let's move on to movies, because you're a screenwriter. I think actually, just even before I ask you for your favourites, when are we going to see your adaptation of Claire Keegan's tremendous novel, Small Things Like These?
I think it's November. I mean, don't sort of like hold me to it, but that's my sense of it, my instinct of it. And but Lionsgate are sort of like, it's in their hands now. So they're distributing it worldwide, certainly sort of like in Europe. Yeah, and America. Yeah.
Big responsibility for you in taking that work on, isn't there? Given that how much loved her work is.
Oh, completely. And also sort of like, yes, that I mean, I'm a big fan of hers. I think she's an absolutely extraordinary writer, but also the subject matter, I think it, to many Irish people, will just feel really
requires, you know, great sensitivity.
Completely. And I mean, but she is the master of tone and getting that right. And it's really, really, it's how she does it with so few words and the right words and whatever. It's just perfect sort of like writing for me. But I must say, I mean, the guys who made it and Killian and the performances, I was just so happy when I saw it in Berlin. I was like, oh my God, they've really made something special. I'm super excited, especially just to as an Irish person, to play it to Irish audiences, for sure.
How many things have you worked with Killian Murphy on now? Because if we go back to Disco Pigs as a play and... Yeah. Ballyturk, I remember as well.
Ballyturk and Mr.
Michael Man. Murphy was terrific in that as well with Killian when he was on in Dublin.
That's right. We've done a bunch of stuff together. It's sort of like I've known him since he was 19, so it feels like I was really, really fortunate to meet him. I think he's and for him to continue to sort of work with me in the way he does, he's a brilliant actor, of course, but he's really thorough. And many people go through their whole lives, I'll throw myself into this as well, you know, and they sort of like, you can bluff your way through a couple of things. He's certainly not a bluffer. He doesn't sort of do general very well, Killian. He's incredibly sort of thorough individual, and does it with such like humor and grace and all the rest, all of that. But he's a fantastic, fantastic worker, great collaborator, brilliant brain.
Your favorite movies, you've given us two. First of all, tell us about A Woman Under the Influence.
It's a John Cassavetes movie from sort of early 1970s. He made it with Gina Rowlands, his wife. She's in the main part. It's probably the best screen performance I've ever seen. Many, many people have ever seen. It's about a woman who, she's suffering with her sort of mental health, and it's Peter Falk is her husband. And it's her basically unraveling over, I think it's a year or something like that. She has sort of kids and la la la. And it's about basically, her going, losing her mind. And it's incredibly harrowing. And it's sort of shot in this sort of cinema verite, sort of uber sort of realistic sort of style that he used to use. So it doesn't look like, none of it looks like acting. It's just like, it feels like a documentary is what you're watching. She is just absolutely extraordinary. I mean, she was still the best screen performance for sure that I can think of. But yeah, it's amazing.
And the other movie you've picked is, I suppose, indulging your love of musicals. Did it come from childhood watching of Singing in the Rain?
Yeah, it did. I think it's sort of like, I was on myself and my dad. My dad was very busy. He had a furniture store and furniture stores all the way through his life and da, 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 and all that sort of thing. But we would sort of sit down, and I loved watching him watching MGM musicals. You know, he was a bit of a sort of like, you know, closet performer himself, I think, you know, you could tap dance and shit like that. And he was a really, really great man, really funny man. And I can remember him, us watching like all those classic sort of like MGM musicals. And Singing in the Rain is still like it's a perfect movie, and it's incredibly funny.
Well, here we have a clip in which Kathy Seldon, played by Debbie Reynolds, and Don Lockwood, played by Gene Kelly, argue the merits of their respective media, stage and film acting.
Tell me, what's your lofty mission in life that lets you sneer at my humble profession?
Well, I'm an actress.
What?
On the stage.
Oh, on the stage. Well, I'd like to see you act. What are you in right now? I could brush up on my English or bring along an interpreter. That is, if they'd let in a movie actor.
Well, I'm not in a play right now, but I will be. I'm going to New York.
Going to New York. And then someday we'll all hear of you, won't we? Kathy Seldon as Juliet, as Lady Macbeth, as King Lear. You'll have to wear a beard for that one, of course.
Oh, you can laugh if you want to, but at least the stage is a dignified profession. And what have you got to be so conceited about? You're nothing but a shadow on film. A shadow. You're not flesh and blood.
Oh, no.
Stop.
What could I do to you? I'm only a shadow.
You keep away from me just because you're a big movie star. Wild party, swimming pools. You expect every girl to fall in a dead faint at your feet. Well, don't you touch me.
Fear not, sweet lady. I will not molest you. I am but a humble jester. And you are too far above me. Farewell, Ethel Barrymore. I must tear myself from your side.
Singing in the Rain. Okay, favorite play. You've gone for a thing called Machinal. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's difficult to sort of pronounce. You can say it that way, or you can say Machinal. There's both sort of pronunciations as far as I know. But I saw it recently. It was a play written in, what was it? I think it was sort of like 1928 or something like that, an American playwright, female playwright. And I think probably one of the first sort of American modernist plays. Sort of structurally, sort of incredibly sort of interesting language-wise, incredibly dark play about, it's been maybe 8 scenes or something like that. And it's about a woman who, this very sort of strange woman who ends up marrying just the wrong guy and then kills this guy. And but she's, again, she's really sort of living on the edge of her own sort of, you know, sense of
person and la la. And I saw it recently. I'd heard of it, but I'd never read it. And I saw it recently, very recently, in the Old Vic and Richard Jones production. And yeah, it was absolutely, it just blew my head away. And I just couldn't believe it was such a, you know, it was written when it was written. And also it filled me with such confidence, I must say. I walked away as a playwright, you know, you go to the sort of theater and if a bad play for me or a bad experience in the theater for me, if I feel something's just too safe and it's not offering anything for the medium, anything like that, I just feel like, oh God, it actually hurts a little bit. And it takes me a while to get over it and go, oh, what am I wasting my time in this business for? And I saw that and it just filled me with like complete sort of joy and sort of confidence to sort of keep on going.
We're going to hear a clip from...
And can I just say the central role was played by this woman called Rosie Shee, who's this Welsh actress. And it was, without doubt, it was like the best performance I've ever seen on stage. It was absolutely extraordinary.
You've done my introduction for me, because this is the clip in which Rosie Shee plays or performs the most iconic monologue from Sophie Treadwell's play.
Marry me. Wants to marry me. George H. Jones. George H. Jones and Company. Mrs. George H. Jones. Mrs. George H. Jones.
Just let me hold your pretty little hands, George H. Jones. Fat hands, flabby hands. Don't touch me, please. Fat hands are never weary. Don't touch me, please. No, can't, must. Subway, air, pressing bodies, trembling air. Stop, air, late, job, no job, fired, late. Alarm clock, alarm clock, alarm clock. Hurry, job! Ma, nag, 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 ma. Rest, no rest, earn, gotta earn. Marry, earn, no, yes, earn. All girls, most girls, ma, pa, ma. All women, most women, I can't. Must, maybe, must, somebody, something. Ma, pa, ma, can I, ma? Tell me, ma, something, somebody.
I should have explained that's the clip from the trailer, because when she performs on stage at the Old Vic Enda, do you have the music in the background?
No. You don't.
I was wondering.
Yeah, it's extraordinary though. Really amazing. Okay. Amazing piece.
Favorite book or author? You've gone for Summer by Edith Wharton. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I read it like a number of years ago. I read The Age of Innocence and The House of Mirth before, and I liked them, but I didn't love them in the way that I love Summer. Summer is like, it's 100 pages, so I guess it's probably a novella. Set in like 1916 rural America, 17-year-old girl. I think her name is Charity Royal or something like that. I think that's the main character. And she sort of lives with her adopted father, like in the middle of nowhere, really. It's sort of a feeling of sort of like poverty, I think, to it. But also it's all about really thwarted dreams and sort of like repressed sexuality type and incest, which is sort of like this... you know, and this visiting architect sort of comes to the air and she falls in love with him. It's absolutely heartbreaking, but the sort of the central character in it, you feel as if you don't like her, but you really, really care about her. She's quite punk in her attitude for this 1970-year-old girl. But it's about just watching her dreams just being sort of like squashed a little bit. And the ending is just the last... you know, like 20 pages of it or whatever in the short novel are really just like stunning. The writing is extraordinary, like really beautiful.
Let's move on to television. What did you watch as a child? What do you remember most from your childhood?
Well, apart from sort of watching MGM musicals with my dad and our sort of love of like, you know, RT used to do like some silent sort of like, you remember, they obviously bought a sort of a truckload of like silent movies back in the like late 70s, early 80s. So we used to watch a lot of Laurel and Hardy and stuff like that. But I mean, the big thing for me as a kid, I mean, I was obsessed with The Incredible Hulk. And all of that, sort of like those great American shows, like the, you know, $6 Million Man or whatever, or Wonder Woman or whatever. I love that. I love the sort of the notion of, you know, out of anger, being able to sort of turn into this complete sort of monster.
But it hasn't aged well, I must say. I just when I looked at the other on YouTube, I was like, God, it's really, really bad. but through the eyes of sort of like, I guess, a sort of 11-year-old boy or whatever, it was extraordinary television, great.
And
event
then,
television.
As an adult, you've opted for The Chef's Table.
Yeah, well, I could have said The Bear, which I'm watching at the moment, but because it's food related as well. I'm sort of like, I'm just...
Sorry, we're getting mixed views on season 3 of The Bear between people who love it and people who think it's not anything like as good as the first 2 series because it's more or less retreading the old ground.
Not for me. I'm sort of really, really, I'm 4 or 5 sort of in. I'm really, really enjoying it. I don't know what the hell happens, but I'm feeling like he's going to, maybe there is a point to that. It might be sort of retread, but for me, I feel like I'm getting close to the characters and that the risk and the threat of what the hell's going to happen is even bigger, you know, and now that they've sort of built this restaurant and all that sort of business. But anyway, it's the thing about it, it could all just blow up in their face, you know, they've
okay.
all of that. But I am obsessed with food.
Tell us about The Chef's Table. It's not one I'm familiar with.
Do you not? Oh, God. So it's on sort of like, it's on Netflix. I think they've only done like two or three series of it. It's literally, it follows, like each episode follows a chef, but a really great chef, like a sort of like, you know, a sort of sushi chef or, you know, a chef that sort of like only makes, I don't know, ramen or whatever it is. And they go into they interview them, they go into their sort of like life and we watch them sort of like, you know, cook and all this sort of thing. But it's, I mean, I really admire, in the way that when I look at The Bear, I really admire sort of like excellence, the pursuit of excellence, but also just being that close to failing and sort of financially failing, the threat of that, but really trying to sort of, you know, trying to grab something that isn't there yet. These like extraordinary minds, it's sort of, you know, it's such an incredibly sort of creative sort of ephemeral sort of business in many ways. Like the meal is just gone, it's nothing, it's sort of digested, it's only fuel for some people or whatever. It seems ridiculous in the same way that sort of theater is or any sort of art is, really. It's sort of like, who the hell cares?
Okay, I'm going to take a brief excerpt from Chef's Table season 1. This is with Chef Ben Shrewry.
When we're working with an Avon Grants, they're very hard to harness. There's no information on the internet about them. There's no books that have recipes using them. When you're developing a dish like the kangaroo dish, you want to take it and work with it as many ways as possible. Over that time, whether it be 3 months or 2 years, you're always thinking, one day I'm going to unlock the greatness of that ingredient. I'm going to find the most delicious and most natural way of cooking with it.
Chef's Table, I'm conscious we're nearly out of time. And we mentioned earlier that you went to Greendale, wasn't it, for your secondary school, where you would have come That's under right. the influence of Roddy Doyle and the man that you've picked as your cultural buried treasure are his work, yeah. The plays of Paul Mercer.
Yeah, I'm a huge Paul Mercer fan. I love him. And I mean, I think many playwrights and Irish playwrights are. To me, he's like sort of like the O'Casey of the 1980s, and what he sort of produced, his work is extraordinary. I remember going to see sort of his work with my mother, my late mother, and she was really, really moved by his work, what he was doing sort of like, you know, structurally as well, taking big sort of risks. And he's an absolute genius of a man. I mean, I was lucky enough to have, you know, Roddy and him sort of like teaching in our school. I got to know Paul after I'd left school and, you know, yeah, he's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant playwright. I hope he writes more plays.
Well, you've had your own brilliant career and there's much more to come in it. Rooms is on in the Shed, Galway Harbour, as part of the Galway International Arts Festival from the 11th of July to the 24th of July. Enda Walsh, it has been a great pleasure having you in the Culture Club. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.